Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 40, and today I'm joined by Vincent Colapietro, liberal arts research professor of philosophy here at Penn State. The depth and breadth of his scholarship can hardly be touched upon in any substantive way in a brief introduction, although I will emphasize that his work focuses on American philosophy, semiotics, and Peirce, but he has published extensively on a wide diversity of issues, including psychoanalysis. His most recent book, Fateful Shapes of Human Freedom, John William Miller and the Crisis of Modernity, was published by Vanderbilt University Press in 2003. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention an essay of his that has meant a lot to my own intellectual development, namely, Striving to Speak in a Human Voice, a Peircean Contribution to Metaphysical Discourse, which was his presidential address to the Metaphysical Society and was published in the Review of Metaphysics in 2004. Vincent joins me today, however, to discuss a profile essay on Richard J. Bernstein he was asked to write for a collected volume entitled Profiles in the Theory of Communication. I thought this would be a great opportunity for us to talk, as Dick Bernstein was a member of my dissertation committee and has had an important and ongoing influence on my intellectual development. I know Vincent and I share many of Bernstein's central philosophical commitments, so it's a pleasure to welcome you, Vincent, to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I thought we could begin by talking a little bit about what you're trying to do in this volume, maybe a little bit about Richard Bernstein's life, just briefly, and then what you're trying to do, because I really was struck in reading it that it resonated with my experience with Dick Bernstein as a person and the philosophical life he's led.
Okay. There's actually something reflexive about the enterprise. The editors were inspired by one of Bernstein's own books, mm-hmm. entitled Philosophical Profiles, in which he offers portraits of Arendt, Heidegger, Dewey, Marcuse, several mm-hmm. others. And so this genre of portraiture is actually something they took from Bernstein himself.
Right.
And what they want to do, especially not for just philosophy, but for the field of communication studies, they want to offer mm-hmm. profiles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was asked, I've written on Richard before, and I was asked to do the profile of him, which is no small task,
right.
Rather daunting.
Right.
And just quickly, what's meant by a profile is taken from him, actually, and it's always a fragment of a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It's an essay in the original sense, an attempt or an endeavor,
right.
Never something pretending to be complete or final. It's always from an angle, from a perspective, and therefore perspectival, fragmentary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and one of the things that I know you spent a brief amount of time at the beginning just talking about, you know, who he is and where he was born, and he's really a major figure in American pragmatist, certainly in the last, American pragmatism, certainly in the 20th century and early 21st century.
Right, right. And it's the interpersonal connections are not insignificant or irrelevant here. So he went as a very young adolescent. I think he was 16 or 17 when he went from Brooklyn to the University of Chicago, and he graduated before he was 20.
Right.
And then he took courses at Columbia in order to beef up his philosophical background, and eventually ended up at Yale, the graduate program at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And there he met a very young junior faculty member by the name of John Smith,
mm-hmm.
and he got caught up in a reading group on Dewey's experience and nature.
Okay.
And he had all of the biases of philosophers of that generation, and he thought, well, what's pragmatism? He had all the stereotypes, and he was just knocked over by that book.
Uh-huh.
Although, in a conversation recently, he said, the book by Dewey that is in some sense most important to him is Art as Experience.
Oh, really?
And I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a more nuanced, more subtle Dewey on display in Art as Experience
mm-hmm.
than even Experience in Nature, which I think is a great book. One of the things that's about Richard is that he's a real person. You know he's a real person. I mean, he's from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And sometimes he sounds like he's from Brooklyn. Uh-huh. His father, you know, had a furniture store, yeah. And when he graduated, his father said, I don't know about this philosophy business. You know, there's always a place for you in the furniture store.
Yeah, I mean, I remember him telling that story to graduate students at the New School, and he really took over the New School. About that, just before mm-hmm. the time when I arrived in 1991, he had taken a department that was really struggling in many ways, and he recognized the degree to which he was a salesperson for philosophy,
right.
And for the New School,
yeah.
and constantly, you know, invoked his father's memory as, you know, I'm really a salesperson.
Right. And one of the things that he was insistent upon when in our recent conversation, not insistent, but he was inviting me to go back and look at it. Yale was not only a place of privilege, it was a place quite of insular privilege during mm-hmm. the 50s and early 60s. And one of the instrumental figures in transforming that environment was William Sloan Coffin,
mm-hmm.
the chaplain
mm-hmm.
there. And he was very active in the anti-Vietnam movement as well as in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And he mobilized a number of folks from Yale to go down to Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Bernstein was one of them.
Mm.
And there's a very nice series of pieces in The Nation from 1965 about the summer in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually introduced by Howard Zinn, mm-hmm. who recently died.
Right.
And it's there are four figures, and I'm going to forget one of them. It's from the perspective of the lawyer, and William Kunstler is the lawyer, and then the educator, and Richard Bernstein is the educator, mm-hmm. and then there's the doctor, and I forget mm-hmm. the fourth figure. But it's he says that at one of those meetings where all the folks are getting together, that's the most concrete and vital image of creative democracy
hmm.
that he's ever experienced. And that's when he thinks about creative democracy in action,
mm-hmm.
he thinks about that.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a great story. I mean, you know, he certainly lives that
right.
kind of dialogical life that you talk about in your essay, but also in that kind of creative democratic sense. He certainly tried to live it at the New School, and mm-hmm. still does. And you know, that's difficult to as we all know
right.
to live in an academic setting. I mean, you know, because that comes with you talk in your piece about the different kinds of pluralism that Bernstein outlines,
mm.
and maybe we could use this as a way to transition to that, because to talk about what the meaning of pluralism for Bernstein is and the different kinds of pluralism, because certainly in an academic setting, that the term pluralism gets used, and
right.
it gets used in a variety of different kinds of ways, and the lived, concrete, fallibilistic pluralism that that you talk about with regard to Richard Bernstein is really difficult to perform as opposed to just theorize.
Right. So it seems to me the very first point to be made is that he does not mean by pluralism relativism,
right.
wherein anything goes and there's no critical way of adjudicating differences. So the engaged pluralism is not merely a negative tolerance. Oh, I'll let you do what you want to do and just stay over in your corner, and I'll stay over in my corner.
Mm-hmm.
Much rather, it's a positive tolerance in which you actually make space for others to be heard
mm-hmm.
in their own idiom and in their own voices and their own inflections.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also the resistance of the temptation to translate others into our own vocabulary or our own framework, and to see the need that we need to be translated,
mm-hmm.
we need to be carried over insofar as it's possible into other vocabularies. So the engaged pluralism is just that. It's an ongoing critical engagement with a variety of perspectives.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I can hear his voice talking about And he does translate. He does say, you know, you could make this point with Gadamer. You could make this point with Habermas. You could, and so he does do some of that,
yes,
of, that
he does.
Of that translating. But I think the point that he always does come back to is there is a kind of irreducibility at a certain level.
Mm, right. And it's unfortunate that one of his, I think, most brilliant, insightful essays, it's been anthologized in the New Constellation. And I won't get the title right. It's on incommensurability, otherness, and it's just a really exquisite piece. And one of the things he argues there is that to say that frameworks are incommensurable does not necessitate they're incomparable, or they cannot be in some respects translated into one another.
Right.
And it's precisely the need to translate and compare what are at bottom incommensurable frameworks and vocabularies.
So I wonder if this, and this is related to an ongoing discussion you and I have had about,
right.
I think what you talk about in some of your essays about the elusive nature of being and what I try to thematize as a certain kind of unicity or singularity, that is this core incommensurability that doesn't preclude the possibility of real genuine connection, real genuine comparability. Even if there's that reminder of the remainder that doesn't go cleanly into concepts or cleanly into languages, or can be translated from one idiom to another,
right? And so there's a wonderful line from James: "Nature is a name for excess." I mean, so it seems to me that nature, and this invites later perhaps talking about naturalism,
right?
But nature exceeds our categories, our conceptualizations, our expressions, our articulations. That doesn't mean our articulations are simply fictive or illusory or they don't have any purchase. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that in the final analysis and quite well before then, there are all kinds of ways in which they can be shown to be inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that the poet realizes this.
Right.
The poet realizes that they're making raids against the unsayable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always something inadequate about even the most adequate expression or articulation.
So maybe this is a question both for you and also maybe for Richard Bernstein's thinking, because I mean, Bernstein never gives up on philosophy.
Right.
And many have. He was good friends with Richard Rorty, who did.
Right.
For certain kind of, perhaps for other reasons. But, and you too, Vincent Colapietro, haven't given up on philosophy, although you, when you appeal to poetry, I have a sense that you're not saying philosophy can't be poetic, but that philosophy is too often not poetic. Right, and sensitive to the excess and to the finitude of our articulations, and I guess I resonate with that. It's one of the things I think you and I continue to talk about, and that I appreciate about Dick Bernstein is that he doesn't throw out philosophy, doesn't throw out even academic philosophy, but continues to stay in the profession and to try to be professional in the profession, and to be a conversationalist in the spirit in which he tries to, in the spirit of genuine dialogue that he tries to enact, and that's not an easy decision to say we're gonna stay here in philosophy and we're gonna try to transform the very meaning of philosophy in a certain kind of way. So maybe I guess I'm asking you about philosophy and it as a less as a profession and more as a way of life, perhaps, is the
right. So part of what I would respond is that philosophy is always, to some degree, metaphilosophy. To question philosophy, to call it into question, is to philosophize. Aristotle said as much, as you know better than I do. So the title of my subtitle of the talk to which you alluded at the outset is metaphysical discourse. And I'm really interested in philosophical discourses. Mm. I'm a pluralist here. And what are the discourses of philosophy? And it seems to me that central to that family of discourses are ones in which argumentation plays a central role.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of philosophy as, in some sense, an unduly contentious but irreducibly argumentative discourse.
Mm-hmm.
One has to give some reasons, and it might be the case that there are certain things for which one cannot give reasons, but one has to give reasons for why that is the case, right?
Right.
And so that seems part of it. The other thing, right there. What are the things for which we give reasons or are obligated to give reasons? And what are those things which fall outside the very possibility, perhaps? And that's a distinction. Maybe it's a distinction without a difference. So the other task of philosophy, it seems to me, not the other, but another central task, is the drawing of the requisite distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, one of the things I always appreciate about Bernstein, and also about a thinker who was near and dear to his heart, Hannah Arendt, are these distinctions now that she makes. And I always come up against these distinctions precisely because they're problematic in certain kinds of ways. But the very drawing of the distinction is what opens up the possibility for delineating the problematic nature of them.
Right. And so one of the deepest controversies between the two of them is the distinction between the political and the social.
Right.
Right? And so it's not that there is not the case that there is not a distinction to be drawn, but how to draw it? What are we doing when we draw it?
Right. Right.
And the dangers of perhaps elevating that into a dichotomy or dualism.
Right, and that would be Bernstein's point against Arendt, that it becomes
exactly
dichotomous in her
right
thinking.
Right.
That actually is making me think a little. I mean, part of the project of this digital dialogue is in part to think through the fact that Socrates annihilates the distinction in some ways between the public and private because he just brings his philosophy into every encounter he has.
Mm.
And he says on the one hand that I'm not going to take political power in the traditional way. I'm not going to perform my political activities in the assembly in using the rhetoric that comes to be expected in Athens at the time. And so in a certain sense, that gets framed in terms of he wasn't a public figure. He didn't practice politics. On the other hand, Socrates himself says, "I may be the only one who's practicing the true art of politics." And so I'm trying to think through this point and the notion that politics is often associated with the public, and it's dependent in a certain sense upon a strict distinction between public and private, which I know is separate from the political and the social. Is it definitely a different? I mean, the social is that sphere that opens up between the private and the public in the Arendtian sense.
But what happens when two citizens, in their role as citizens, engage in a debate about the public good or about justice, but they do so in what would normally be identified as a private sphere?
Right. Well, and I'm also thinking about what's happening in our classrooms, you know, because there's a whole a set of things that are operative there, and they're not political in an overt sense, but they are always political in a certain sense because we don't leave the mantle of our citizenship at the door when we enter into the classroom.
Institutionally speaking, the classroom is a private sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so vis-a-vis the government.
Right, right.
So there are various senses of public here.
Right, yeah, I think that's
right.
It
seems to me that when a citizen engages another citizen about matters of state, there's something bearing upon the public.
Right.
But that doesn't make the exchange public.
Right, right. I think, there's all kinds of ways, and this is probably getting into a larger discussion in a certain tangential sense, but there are a lot of ways in which social media technology, if it is permitted to come into the classroom in certain kinds of ways, makes the classroom more public than it traditionally has been, and really, and for better and for worse, and for better perhaps because it allows the thinking and the ideas in the classroom to touch the world, the real world,
right,
and other people outside of the classroom. On the other hand, with that comes potential problems because other kinds of communication can enter in ways that might be disruptive to the class.
Do you know of anybody who tries to sort out the meanings of the public?
I can't think of anybody offhand, but I'm sure there are some theorists that are doing that with regard to philosophy of education. And
right, because this seems to me very, very important, because it's the term is shot through with ambiguity.
Right.
Right. As we're talking, I'm realizing. I always had a vague sense of this. I'm having a sharper sense of it.
Well, so, I mean, and this is actually the point that you made in your essay that I thought is somewhat related to what we're talking about right now, which is the notion of being a conversationalist. Hmm. And Bernstein is his writing is, in a certain sense, conversational. And he tries to, in a certain way, you can hear his voice when you read his work, his philosophical work as well. And I wonder about that. You made a point in the essay about the importance of bringing the written word into connection with the spoken word, and how that plays out. Because of course there are also there's a flip side of that. Maybe it's because I'm preparing to teach critical theory and I'm thinking about the other side, which is sort of Adorno's point of making these things sort of more difficult, perhaps, so that people have to really work a little bit harder to get into the theory, and so that the theory is perhaps protected against being misused in certain kinds of ways. I'm not making commentary on the felicity of such a strategy, but I think Bernstein's impulse is the opposite in a certain way, to speak the language in an accessible way.
Right. But he's not impatient with very difficult or opaque, right? He doesn't just dismiss them. You were not implying that at all. So I think there is the need to resist the demand for immediate intelligibility or immediate accessibility. I also think that perhaps Adorno overdoes it. I think his motivation's mixed. Peirce had that as well. It was almost as though if he was contemptuous of people who could too easily understand him, so he tried very hard to be difficult. Mm-hmm. I mean, on occasion, that's of course not his permanent stance. So what is one trying to do when one is writing? Who is one trying to reach? Those are hard questions. Right. And again, I'm a pluralist. I don't think there's any one way of doing it. I do think even in the case of the critical theorist, there is the conversational model. In some ways, works. Mm-hmm. It's about talking back. It's about engaging Heidegger as a figure who might be lampooned,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. But I mean, it's not. It's more than just a metaphor.
Right.
The vocabulary of conversation. Although I do like the notion that there may be. In fact, we touched on this briefly in the Digital Dialogue 39. I was talking to Sam Richards and Laurie Mulvey, who are the co-directors of what was the Race Relations Project, now is being called the World in Conversation Project. And they chose the word conversation, and I was making the point that there's a notion of turning, the possibility of turning.
Right,
of,
that's good.
Right, of transformation.
Yeah. Inclination would be to say is to resist the notion it's just well you say it's not just a metaphor,
right?
Well, I might say it is only a metaphor, but it's an especially apt one,
right,
that cannot be stated better in a more literal way.
Right. No, I think you're right. You've touched exactly on the point. I mean, you know, that was a loaded turn of phrase that I used, because I mean I think you and I both agree that the metaphor of metaphor itself, the bringing across the project of translation, which is what the word really means, is critical, and that's what we're involved in. So when you say just a metaphor, you're suggesting that poetic language or imaginative language is some kind of diminished language or
Right, and it has to be legitimated by being translated into literal discourse.
Right.
And I don't think that necessarily is the case. I think what happens is that metaphors become commonplace. The Greek word for what? Wood or timber becomes matter.
Right. Exactly.
So it's the original imposition is metaphorical.
So maybe we could turn back to the whole issue of rationality.
Mm.
Because rationality traditionally can come to mean, that hasn't always meant that, but can come to mean this prejudice toward the clear, prejudice toward the unambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And so metaphor and poetry and all of that sort of was on one side and reason was on the other. Now, if we go back and think about Logos, we have a very rich tradition from the Greeks, but also, I mean, you know, the Muthos Logos distinction was even operating there, and so part of what I'm hearing you say is that we need an inclusive and more expansive conception of what rationality might mean.
Right, and so I would think that we would necessarily need to tell a story
mm-hmm.
about the history of reason, and so I think the two are inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
I think poetry and philosophy are distinct but also inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
I think they enliven one another. They revivify one another. I do think that. I think that Smith distinguishes between formal and living reason. It's more or less a distinction in the pragmatist tradition. It's probably nowhere as clearly articulated as in his own writings
mm-hmm.
in Experience and God. And there are ways in which Richard also uses that expression, living reason. So it seems to me that if you're talking about formal abstract reason, which certainly has its place and its power,
mm-hmm.
but that's one thing. But at bottom, even that, it seems to me, is an exercise of living reason.
Right.
Because those empty symbols have meaning only insofar as they are imaginatively interpreted by living rationality.
So when you talk about Richard Bernstein as being a pragmatist with experience, that he really is someone who takes experience seriously, is that yeah. part of what you're talking about, the notion of living reason and this affirmation of reason in the lived experience, in concrete conversation, saying the hard things to one another that we need to say.
Right, and that radiates out from a particular technical disagreement between Rorty and many other pragmatists, including Bernstein, which is that Rorty is a pragmatist without experience,
right.
And he
embraces it.
Right, yeah, no, he celebrates it. And it's an interesting move, and it's not one with which I'm completely out of sympathy, because what he says is everything the pragmatists, classical pragmatists, were trying to do with the notion of experience can be done much more effectively with the Wittgensteinian notion of language game.
Mm-hmm.
And then it slips into replacing experience with language.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rorty is the emblem for pragmatism without experience.
Right.
And Smith and Bernstein, a number of people have said, no, you can't. This doesn't work. This is like Freud without the unconscious or mm-hmm. Marx without revolution. Mm-hmm. Pragmatism without experience just doesn't work.
Right.
Then one has to go back and realize that experience is never adequately articulated, that which drives toward expression, but is never fully disclosed in any articulation.
Right.
And so this notion of excess.
Mm-hmm. So we're back in a certain sense to nature, in the Deweyan sense and in the sense it's used in Experience
right.
in nature, where you have, where experience in a certain way and the appeal to it is the way in which we humans are brought up against that which we don't have control over mm. or that which brings us up short, that which is excessive to our abilities to articulate, even if it gives itself to articulation
right.
to some degree.
Right. And one of the things I'm trying to do here, and I'm trying to do it inspired by a whole number of people, is grant a certain degree of agency to objects.
Mm-hmm.
So objects are not just mute presences upon which we project our fantasies or whatever. In psychoanalytic discourse, Christopher Bolas and others have, Bolas in particular, has spoken about the evocative object.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that objects do call forth responses.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, they're not just passively waiting. They intrude, they interrupt. The very word object is a dynamic word.
Right.
It's that which throws itself in our way. It just doesn't throw it's not just an obstacle or an obstruction or an obsistence. It's something which might be a lure, might be a seduction for our attention. So it seems to me that our experience itself, and I'm stealing this from Charles Hartshorne. I one time had the privilege and the pleasure as a graduate school student of conversing with Hartshorne. In that conversation, he said, experience has the structure of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it doesn't matter if we're talking about a person walking in the woods. The woods is evoking a response from the person walking.
Well, I mean, the reason why I mentioned the Striving to Speak in Human Voice essay that you wrote is primarily in part because of this point that you're making right now, which really was in many ways a kernel for my thinking, rethinking some of the things I had previously thought about Aristotle and the nature of truth, which sort of was articulated then in this book that'll come out in November. Aristotle and the Nature of Truth, and it is this notion, and I appeal to you and to Smith and to others about Bruno Latour, for example, and that the object is objecting, can right. object, objects right. can object
right.
to our attempts to address them,
mm.
and that we're always being addressed and addressing. And those are attempts to put words to things, succeed and fail. But the notion of responsibility, the ability to respond that I try to articulate in that book, is really bound up with the notion that our relationships to the things that we encounter are dialogical, and that they and that things are active in that dialogue as much as we are, and we are passive as much as they are. So I try to make a lot of the middle voice
right.
way in which this dialogue occurs. We can't just parse it easily
right.
into subject and object, and that's part of the problem of that dichotomy.
I think in some respects we're passive. I do think it's easy to slide into, however, an equation between passivity and receptivity.
Mm-hmm.
When we receive somebody into our house, we do a lot to make sure the house looks a certain
right,
way.
Right.
It's a very active,
right?
right?
Mm-hmm.
So receptivity can be a very active,
right.
imaginative, preparatory
right.
stance.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, you make this point in this essay with regard to Bernstein, although I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about this. I mean, I hear less of the vocabulary of active stance, less of Dewey's talk of habits.
Mm.
And my own interest in virtues or excellences of dialogue in
mm-hmm.
Bernstein's thinking, then, although at the end of the essay that you cite him, and he talks about courage, and he talks about some of these other kinds of things that one would need, one mm-hmm. does need
right.
to lead a conversation. Although I don't know, maybe he does thematize it in different kinds of ways in his work. Thematize the excellence of dialogue. I mean, he performs them. He lives them in certain kinds of ways.
I think he does. What I don't think is that the so-called Socratic virtues are given as central a place. It's almost as though they're so obvious. Why belabor the point?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's
mm-hmm.
what he. But he. I think he's very explicit about there have to be material and moral conditions more or less in place for a dialogue even to begin in however rudimentary and halting a way. Mm-hmm. It's not just intellectual virtues.
Right. I mean, I think that's certainly key to my reading of Aristotle, is that you have to understand the ethical, the so-called ethical, and the intellectual virtues together. Mm-hmm.
Part of my interest in psychoanalysis is that all of us have been damaged in ways that make it really easy for us to deflect things, not to hear.
Mm.
And so there's this very rich discourse about ways in which we are suffering from self-inflicted blindness and deafness.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems if we're going to take dialogue seriously, we need to figure out why it's so damnably difficult.
Yeah.
It's such a delicate, difficult process.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I've been coming to in the course of these conversations I've been having through the digital dialogue, but also just rereading some of the Socratic texts, is the importance of what I think is called attentive listening in Socrates, and he gestures to it. It's not thematized as much as some other virtues are. But what
there's
does this
that therapeutic mean? Dimension, it seems
yes.
to me, explicitly
sure.
in Plato, right?
Sure.
So you have this therapeutic dimension. Merkin, who actually she's not one of my favorite writers on these topics, but she's been in recent New York Times magazines. But she does have a characterization of therapy that I rather like, which is a corrective form of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
So be engaged in a communicative process, the goal of which is to institute a corrective form of intimacy. We all know how to be intimate with others, but we're intimate in ways that are hurtful, that drive them away. And it seems to me that something similar here or analogous is to engage in corrective forms of inquiry and conversation.
Yeah.
Engage in a conversation, part of the function of which is to learn what one's doing and how to do it better.
Right. I mean, it's interesting, the vocabulary of intimacy, because that problematizes that distinction between public and private in a very interesting way. Right. And it also opens up the whole sphere of trust and a lot of issues that aren't usually associated with politics in the very public traditional mm-hmm. sense of understanding. But I guess part of the point that I want to think about is that there's a political dimension to that sort of therapeutic intimacy. And the political dimension, it's about community. And so that's really the sort of sense of the polis that I want to hit upon, and I actually bring that up with regard to Bernstein. The drive toward community seems to be animating much of what he does, but he doesn't have a naive conception of how difficult that is.
Right, and part of it, and this is as much Cavell as anyone, part of it is what I call the work of acknowledgement,
mm-hmm.
Working toward an ever deeper acknowledgement of the depth and ways in which we are always already bound up with others.
Right.
And that, but conjoined with that, it seems to me, is that our resistance to acknowledging that,
mm-hmm.
and so these defenses and resistances.
So what is that? I mean, so you make mention of Bernstein's Cartesian anxiety. You and I have talked a lot about the notion of foundational thinking and how that can be a problematic metaphor to use sometimes. But that as a response to a certain kind of what Bernstein, I think, would call condition, what I think you would call fate in a certain way.
Right.
Right. And it's really human finitude that we're coming up against, and a kind of response to that. Mm. How do we respond to that? I mean, objectivism is one response, relativism is a kind of other response, but there is this. You thematize Bernstein's response of engaged fallibilistic pluralism as a kind of response to that human fate.
And it's in a somewhat simplistic way, but I don't think too crudely. There are always two possibilities in any encounter with the other. Dialogue is at minimum an encounter with the other, and there's always two possibilities. Distinct possibilities. I think there are more. But we can annihilate ourselves, or we can annihilate the other. And does the encounter involve missing, just simply missing the other in some radical sense, by a self-imposition? Or does it involve allowing the other to be present in a way that spells my absence or my negation? And so the way in which, at the most minimal level, cohabitation, being with the other, fully with this other, this concrete other, right? And it's very difficult. And so I don't think there's anything unduly sentimental or utopian here, but I do think it's as, it's as simple and difficult as the question of cohabitation, which we haven't solved morally or politically, and given our technological advances, it becomes all the more urgent. Right.
So when you talk a little bit about what you mean by cohabitation.
Okay. So I mean, I simply mean living with other beings, other than ourselves, and that just might be taken in any way whatsoever, and be with other species of animals.
Sure.
With other forms of life.
Right. So one of the things that I come to thematize in this Aristotle book is the notion of cohabitation as sharing habits, the fact that things give themselves to me to be understood, heard, even seen or felt, touched, is because they have certain habits that I can encounter, that I am built to encounter, so that I have habits that I can share with them. And so in that sense, I want to draw on both the sort of Aristotelian and Deweyan notion of habit, but I also want to emphasize this as a living and lived condition, that it's a matter of living together. And that's how we gain these habits.
And it's important to resist seeing the individual, in particular the isolated individual, as the locus of habits, because it seems to me that what we have are loci of habits. And it's Dewey's point, the walking is as much a function of the ground as it is the feet and the legs, or the air. So it's always this transaction. It's and that means there are properties of the natural environment which are as basic, as crucial as the organic structures, the habits that we have. So the locus of the habit is in the transactor.
So you ascribe that to Dewey, and I think that's there, certainly there. I mean, I've read it in beautiful passages of Woodbridge, right? Where you know that we have feet to walk in the world is and the air to breathe. So too, we have the mind to think the ideas of nature as well in a certain kind of way. Does that come from Santayana? I mean, does that come for Woodbridge? I thought it sort of came from Santayana. It wouldn't come from that for Dewey, do you think?
I think it comes from Aristotle.
Well, okay.
I think it's probably most arrestingly and poetically put by Santayana.
Yeah.
But where it all, I mean, where they would claim it came from would be Aristotle.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I guess I was just thinking
the
about
more
the
proximate.
The more proximate provenance of that question and that set of ideas between Dewey and Woodbridge. What was there? Were they talking to each other in such a way that they would have been, you know, re-emphasizing those ideas?
Yes,
and that American naturalist
perspective.
Very
much so.
Yeah, and Randall would be in there.
And Randall, he's one of my favorites. He's one of those unnoticed and neglected figures that it'd be good to recover.
Well, I have appreciated your suggesting that I attempt to do some recovery of Randall, and I think Randall's voice can be certainly heard in some of the things I say in my Aristotle book. I certainly learned a lot from him, and I continue to learn a lot from you, Vincent, and as I did from Richard Bernstein, and continue to do from him. So I really thank you for joining me on the Digital Dialogue today.
Well, thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/CPL2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.